Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Tuesday, April 9, 2024. South Sudan's Electoral Commission says the country is ready for elections.
The policy or the statement which has been released several times by different bodies has become now a reality that we are going to conduct elections.
And Sudan's conflict cripples South Sudan's oil industry.
Continued fighting limits processes of maintenance for the pipeline. As you can see, since the damage was inflicted on the pipeline in February.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. As the clock ticks toward December, South Sudanese living in the capital Juba are skeptical about the December 2024 elections. One Juba resident says he does not see any signs of preparation for the poll. The country's National Elections Commission insists that South Sudanese will soon see activities aimed at preparing the nation for its first democratic exercise. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar has this report from Juba.
It is business as usual in the South Sudanese capital, Juba. Residents say there is very little sign in the city that shows the country is heading for elections at the end of the year. Emmanuel John doubts the country can be ready.
The citizens of this country are really for the elections. The citizens wanted to choose who is their leader, as it is the democracy of each and every country in the world. But my perspective really about this coming election 2024, I'm not sure. Because the way I'm seeing it, like the political will are not there. You see any civic engagement, like there's a signpost that there's a coming election, this, it is not there. It is really signified that there's no election.
At Muduria roundabout, several large billboards can be seen bearing the images of government activities and other advertisements. But none of the billboards in the town mentioned any election-related activity. 24-year-old Akwal Makwach, who grew up in neighboring Uganda, says the city doesn't look like a place preparing to vote.
I haven't seen any signs, but I see people on the internet saying that the elections will be there, especially government officials. I don't think South Sudan is ready for elections than the Ugandan one. Because in Uganda, there were a lot of preparations, like I've received a lot of campaigns, but I don't see any campaigns. I'm only left for 7 months.
At tea shops around Juba, the talk is about the polls. But some residents, such as 23-year-old Molly Joseph, who runs a tea shop, are uncertain there will be election.
So I heard like that, but I'm not seeing anything about election. Not for reaction, I'll be so up, girl, for election. How to vote? This is my first time. I've never even tried. I'm a Jerry Busa with Yom Dani. Lord be careful. Ektimal Zatu, Minkin Nazbija, misunderstand up.
The South Sudan National Election Commission says it is rolling out election activities. Abenego Akuk is the commission chairperson.
This is the second day of my declaration of civic education, which is our first priority, that the policy or the statement which has been released several times by different bodies has become now a reality, that we are going to conduct elections.
Omara Joseph Wani, who works for the South Sudan Human Rights Defenders Network, says there are a range of issues that make South Sudanese skeptical about the coming vote, including the economic situation.
There is no doubt that South Sudan is currently under very critical condition. As we citizens continue to suffer economic hardships, this has exacerbated the plight of the people, further creating an intolerable environment that may not be conducive to conduct credible elections come December 2024. As the network, we are very much concerned by the current political and economic dynamics happening in the country, which may lead to ultimate collapse of rule of law.
Wani calls on the country's leaders to work together to find solutions to pressing issues before thinking of conducting a rushed election. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayer in Juba.
Land grabbing reportedly by armed men in South Sudan's capital Juba has ignited a fierce debate over how land distribution should be regulated by clear policies to avoid another crisis in the country. Tong Deng Ane moderates a social gathering of more than 500 South Sudanese from different backgrounds. He tells my colleague John Tanza, South Sudan needs honest dialogue on how land issues are handled.
John, there are some different level of dialogue. Because like the land issue is a policy issue. There is a need for a policy that need to be put out by the government. They need to put a land act. That land act will govern the land issues in South Sudan. Because, and that policy, when it is produced, there is a need for advocacy. Where there will be advocacy, people will be educated on that policy. There will be, that policy can be presented at the public universities, at the churches, at the school, and all these different places. That is the dialogue that I'm talking about. It is not that these people who are beating their chest, you know, I have done this and this. These, those people who are beating their chest, they are doing the wrong thing. Because what happened is that we fought for this country, yes. But we were fighting to create a freedom for all the South Sudanese. It is not that it was being used to oppress our people. So it is a fighting that you were fighting to make sure that the oppression that was happening to South Sudanese that does not happen again. People need to have that freedom, and that's why they were able to get the independence. It is not that but the people, if you look even type of people who are beating their chest, they don't even have any authority. They just have that way of talking. But you need to make a policy that will give a right to everybody. That is what is needed. There has been absence of policy that is protecting the right of the landowners, that is protecting the right of the people who are also looking for land.
We're talking about chest beating. You know, there are people who are beating their chest. I know some of them who deserted the front line during the SPLA war with the Khartoum government, who deserted from front line, ran to Kakuma refugee camp, and then went for a third country solution. You know, they resettled in a third country. And then when peace agreement was signed, they came back to South Sudan and started beating their chest. How many of these such people are there on Sunrise who beat their chest?
Okay, no, what I can say is that, no, it also takes me back to what I was saying. You know, there are people who were in South Sudan here. There are people who migrated to other countries. There are people who were in Khartoum. They were not part of the war. So they were all about who were in different places. But the fact of the matter is that it was not a choice for South Sudanese to be in those places. It was the war that taking them to Khartoum, or the war taking them to Kakuma, to any other country. It was a war. But now that we have peace, everybody's back. And what we need to do is for us to have that, what I'm saying, dialogue, reconciliation, so that we see each other as brothers and sisters. We don't see each other as enemies. We don't see each other as land grabbers. We don't see each other as people, landowners who don't want anybody in their land. We need to see ourselves as South Sudanese, regardless of which direction you come from. Wherever you come in the years or ways or thoughts, you are a South Sudanese and you should be considered as the South Sudanese. And this is what we don't need this discrimination among ourselves completely. This is something that we don't like to have. And that is one thing now I can tell you in the Sunrise Forum. We have everybody. We don't discriminate anyone. Whether you are a civil society, whether you are activist or a government official or from other political parties, what we consider is the identity of the South Sudanese. The identity that we consider is the South Sudanese. So, and this is why we want everybody to be seen like that. And we want to see John Tanza as the South Sudanese, regardless of the job that you do. We see you as a South Sudanese. All of us have job, but we don't take a job as a position, or we don't take whatever you do as you see yourself as a citizen of this country. This is what we want.
Well said, Tong. It is important that we should look at each other as South Sudanese, as equals. You're preaching to a wild crowd that does not see unity in purpose as one way of coexistence. Let me give you an example. There is this notion that the people of Equatoria are cowards just because they don't like confrontation. Have you come across such discussions at Sunrise?
No, I mentioned to you, I'm a South Sudanese, and I know the behavior of different type of people. And what you are saying, yes, I've seen that, not only in Sunrise. But even people like us, who don't like creating problems to others, we are taken as stupid. We don't know anything. But that is not the right thing. What is important is that Equatorian are peaceful people who don't want to fight with anybody. And those people should be taken as good people. So somebody who doesn't like to create problems should be taken in a positive way as a good person, but it should not be taken as a coward person. But there is that behavior. You see, John, there is also a trauma with that. This is a fact that we need to accept. People have been in wars for over 50 years, and that has created a trauma where people think that when you behave negatively is when your case will be heard. But that is not the way. I can come and present my case to you in a very peaceful way, in a very respectful way, that you will understand that this person has the case. But if I come to you arrogantly, you will also respond the same way, and that is where the conflict occurs. So we need to have that sense of respect, a sense of unity where we accept each other. This is what we need. But there is also a need for trauma advocacy, where we can advocate for this trauma to go away. Because sometimes you see that people are act very angrily, and you see, what is it? Even something that simple that people are discussing, you find that people act so negatively about it. And this is something that we need. It is all our work, all of us, to advocate about it and make people, that our people, make the right decision.
That's Tong Dengane, one of the moderators of Sunrise WhatsApp group. He spoke with my colleague John Tanza on Monday. The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of Sudanese continue to flee every day to neighboring countries in search of safety. A year on from the start of the war, the UNHCR reports more than 8.5 million people have been uprooted from their homes, including 1.8 million refugees. As desperation increases and donor countries ignore their plight, the UNHCR warns many people are risking their lives by embarking on long, dangerous journeys to safety. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
More than 8.5 million people, including 1.8 million refugees, have been forced to flee their homes since war erupted on April 15, 2023, making this one of the largest displacement and humanitarian crises in the world. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports fighting between the Sudanese armed forces and paramilitary rapid support forces has shattered people's lives. It says attacks on civilians are escalating. Human rights violations are widespread and rampant, and the economy has collapsed. UNHCR spokeswoman Olga Serrato says thousands of desperate Sudanese, mainly women and children, are fleeing across borders every day as if the emergency had started yesterday and not a year ago.
Chad has experienced the largest refugee arrivals in its history, while teams from UNHCR and partners continue to work and relocate refugees to expanded and new settlements. Over 150,000 remain in border areas in overcrowded and unsanitary conditions, mainly and largely due to funding shortfalls.
UNHCR reports more than 1,800 people are arriving in South Sudan every day, increasing pressure on overstretched infrastructure and worsening the vast humanitarian needs. It says nearly 640,000 people, many of them South Sudanese returnees, have arrived in the country to date. Serrato says other neighboring countries of asylum, including the Central African Republic, Egypt, and Ethiopia, also are experiencing large daily inflows of Sudanese refugees.
Those crossing borders, mostly women and children, are arriving in remote areas with little to nothing and in desperate need of food, water, shelter, and medical care. Many families have been separated and arrive in distress. People and children have witnessed or experienced appalling violence and making psychosocial support a priority.
As the conflict continues, Serrato says more people will be forced to flee Sudan to neighboring countries. She warns many are likely to risk their lives by embarking on long, dangerous journeys seeking safety in countries further afield. UNHCR statistics show more Sudanese refugees are going to Europe, with 6,000 arriving in Italy from Tunisia and Libya since the beginning of 2023, an almost six-fold increase from the previous year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, Sudanese mark 1 year since the start of the current conflict with a call for peace. Find out more after this break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. As the conflict in Sudan reaches its one-year mark, its effects have crippled the economy of South Sudan. Local and international organizations say the influx of returnees and refugees into South Sudan has already worsened the dire humanitarian conditions across the country. John Tanza discusses with Brian Adiba, Senior Policy Advisor for Sudan and South Sudan at the Century, the lessons and impact of Sudan's conflict for the two countries and what should be done to address the conflict-related humanitarian crisis in the two Sudans.
Continued fighting limits processes of maintenance for the pipeline. As you can see, since the damage was inflicted on the pipeline in February, One of the reasons that is constantly being cited about why the situation has not been rectified has to do with the access to the pipeline itself and the facilities. And so if maintenance is not conducted quickly, the oil gels in the pipeline, and then it makes it really difficult to get things flowing again. The other risk is the pipeline itself being caught up in the internal politics of the war between the RSF and the Sudanese armed forces. The RSF has so far said that it's not interested in deliberately damaging the oil facilities in Sudan because these are ostensibly a national resource. However, the fact that the flow of the oil tends to benefit one actor in the conflict, which is the SAF, the oil proceeds from the pipeline and all of that benefit the government, is going to be a concern to the RSF. The other risk coming from that conflict in Sudan, for South Sudan is, you know, the long porous border basically means that the possibility of the entry of small arms, unregulated flow of small arms into South Sudan is increased exponentially as well. So all of that reduces their potential to monitor the border and will then enhance the flow of small arms into the country. That's another risk. The other risk is the risk we are seeing right now with regard to South Sudanese mercenaries participating in the war, and perhaps on both sides. But so far, we're only seeing that the RSF is the participation is predominantly on the RSF. I have tracked the patterns related to the South Sudanese mercenary participation in the conflict. And using open source intelligence and mostly TikTok videos, social media videos and stuff like that. And there are certain patterns that are emerging. One, we see that the recruitment is coercive, and that coercive recruitment has focused on recruiting South Sudanese that are resident in territories controlled by the RSF. Young South Sudanese men being forced to join the RSF. With promises of money, but that money has turned out not to have been paid to the South Sudanese mercenary fighters. The second recruitment, there seems to be like a pipeline of recruits coming from the northern regions of the country. Particularly, we've seen this, we've seen videos of fighters coming from all the way from northern Bahar Ghazal state, and also from Unity, and also from Abyei. What then happens to these fighters who have acquired these weapons and experience, and the example of the Tuaregs who are fighting with Gaddafi in the Libyan civil war during the Arab Spring, going back to Mali and causing all that instability that Mali is now thrown into since 2013. So there's the long-term risk of fighters returning with their weapons, and they may pose a security threat to South Sudan. And so those are some risks that I see with this conflict.
You were talking about the internalization of the conflict, meaning it's spilling over into South Sudan. But what lessons could be learned from this Sudanese crisis in the backdrop of the effects crippling the whole economy of a country, What lessons could be learned by the authorities in South Sudan?
I think one of the lessons that can be learned from this episode in Sudan is the danger of having auxiliary militia forces recruited outside the premises of the law to serve the narrow whims of certain politicians. The RSF is basically a militia outfit that was recruited to do the dirty work of the Sudan Armed Forces. And the danger then is, how do you incorporate such forces that are acting outside the law into the armed forces of the country? Even though it was by parliamentary feat that the RSF was incorporated into the SAF in 2017, it actually really remained, this incorporation was nominal. To a large extent, the RSF was autonomous, an autonomous force. And so that's the lesson that we have to learn, our politicians in South Sudan have to learn. Recruiting auxiliary forces, militia forces, to support the armed forces in certain ways is going to have detrimental effects down the road when it comes to integrating these forces into the regular armed forces.
And looking at the mainstay of South Sudan, which is oil, and this oil, like you said before, is now in the center and front of this conflict. What would you advise authorities in South Sudan to do in future to avoid a situation where their crude is passing through a country that is instable?
I think the key lesson really is to diversify the revenue sources for the government of South Sudan. Their dependence, the sole dependence on oil, is detrimental, is risky. As we've seen now, you know, to get the oil out, it has to pass through another country, and where the situation is unstable in that country, that means then that you are at risk, and you're even at more risk when that oil is your sole revenue source. And for the lesson for South Sudanese politicians and for the country itself would be to diversify our revenue sources in South Sudan. Let's jerk up agricultural production and exports. And as you see right now, you know, the South Sudan pound is in a tailspin against the U.S. dollar, and that's because of the reliance on this sole revenue source.
When you talk about policy issues, I know that you are a senior policy advisor on Sudan and South Sudan. What would be one advice you would give to the two countries, or even to the belligerent forces in Sudan?
I think for South Sudan, politicians must take a neutral track in dealing with the sides in the Sudanese conflict, because their oil pipeline passes through that country, and in territory controlled by both belligerent parties in South Sudan. And therefore, it's really important for South Sudanese politicians to tread the neutral path and engage in dialogue with both sides in this conflict, and not appear to be supporting the other one side in the conflict, because that will jeopardize the oil pipeline completely. For Sudanese politicians, I think that
The war is not going to resolve anything. It's important to find a middle ground, to come to the negotiating table and discuss a peaceful track to resolving the conflict. Ultimately, for Sudan, really, like, the resolution of this conflict should culminate in the installation of a civilian democratic government. Anything short of that is going to cause further instability in the country.
That's Brian Adeva, senior policy advisor for Sudan and South Sudan at the Century here in Washington. He spoke with John Tanza earlier today from the state of Maryland. A rare total solar eclipse descended on the central United States for about 4 minutes on April 8th. VOA's Kane Faraba reports from the Midwest state of Indiana, where the event drew thousands of spectators from across the country.
The decision to come to Indianapolis, Indiana's famous Motor Speedway to join the crowd of spectators witnessing a total solar eclipse came at the last minute for Enrique Catalan and his family. It was supposed to be a regular day of school for his children.
We're skipping today, yes. They're approved by us.
Catalan and his family drove 2 hours from northern Indiana to witness something that had left an impression on him as a teenager in Mexico during a partial eclipse.
The experience, it was unique to me. So that's why we're here, because I remember when it happened when I was young. And now I want them to experience it as well. Well, they are going to experience the total eclipse.
The racetrack was one of several locations where NASA and its partners hosted programming in the Path of Totality, the swath of the U.S. that can see the moon completely blocking the sun as the eclipse makes its way northeast. Charles and Kathy Maher from Chicago, Illinois, felt sharing the event with the massive crowd in Indianapolis was a unifying moment in a country politically polarized in a presidential election year.
Nobody's going to be talking about what side the sun is on or the moon is on, or, you know.
It's not red or blue. It's
right, right, exactly. Right. So, yeah, it is sort of a little break from everything that's going on.
Today, millions of Americans will stand together looking up at the sky in awe and wonder at this cosmic coincidence that makes our moon look like it's exactly the same size as the sun.
NASA Deputy Administrator Pam Melroy says her agency's efforts to study this rare event weren't isolated to just a few locations across the country.
We have a program where some people have been trained to use solar telescopes all around the country.
Meng Chang is president of Indiana's Purdue University, which boasts a number of graduates who became NASA astronauts. He hopes the accessibility of the eclipse to a large number of young Americans might help inspire them to pursue careers in science.
It's not just a watch party for 3 minutes. It is a lifelong educational journey, and today is a very meaningful special stop along that journey.
For those who missed witnessing the 2024 total solar eclipse, the next opportunities to see one firsthand in the United States won't occur until 2044 and 2045. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Indianapolis, Indiana.
And that's all we have for you this Tuesday, April 9th, 2024. We now leave you with Emmanuel Kembe and the song Kifaya. Listening to Emmanuel Kembe and the song Kifaya, I'm your host Nabil Biagio on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. Don't miss our special coverage of Sudan's darkest year. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Cornelius Tenner, We wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Come for a car, he ain't